Now we're going to do something that for many years polite etiquette has demanded that we never, ever do. We're going to talk about politics, sex and religion all at the one time and ask the question, where are we with love, intimacy and sex in what my next guest describes as the I world? Professor Dale Keane is a professor of politics at Anselm College, New Hampshire in the United States, and about the only politics professor in the whole of the USA who's also an ordained Christian minister. Dale has been brought here to Australia for a lecture tour by the Centre for Public Christianity. He's written a book with an immediately arresting title, Sex and the I World, Rethinking Relationship Beyond an Age of Individual. That's what the I stands for in I World, not internet, as I thought, but the individual. He says it's a world in which the immediate desires of the individual have been deemed paramount, which is fine, I guess, if you're the only person on the planet, but we are not. Professor Keane, thanks so much for joining us on Open House.
I'm so glad to be here.
It's great to have you with us. Can I start by asking, how does a professor of politics end up writing a book about sex?
Well, I found myself in a situation where I couldn't avoid it because I'm smart enough to know that it's something that should be avoided at all costs. I am the only ordained politics professor in the United States. I'm located in New Hampshire, and for those of you who have watched The West Wing, you'll know that the New Hampshire primary is the most important event in the presidential selection process. It's been my honor to be someone who hosts the presidential candidates, the nationally televised debates. On June 13th, we'll be doing a national televised debate on CNN, which if CNN International picks it up, you'll be able to watch. But over my time there, I've become acquainted not just with the presidential candidates, but the national media. And the national media often call me for sound bites when it comes to religion and politics. And when Eugene Robinson was ordained the first bishop, openly gay bishop in the Anglican Church in New Hampshire, 2 miles from me, the press called me up to ask me what I thought. And I'm smart enough to know that what I should say is no comment.
Wise, yes. Probably.
And I did return those phone calls, which in a position of mine is not a good idea. But then shortly thereafter, the Massachusetts Supreme Court decided that the Puritans had inserted a clause into the Massachusetts Constitution allowing for same-sex marriage. And so the press was back at my door asking me what I thought. And I realized that as a politics professor, I can say no comment. As a pastor, I can't, or I should turn in my credentials. So Bishop Robinson and I were on a radio show one night, a discussion that disguised as a debate. And I explained why I didn't think the Bible supported same-sex marriage. Bishop Robinson said, you know, I couldn't agree with Reverend Keane more. The Bible's not a book about science and history and this and that. It's a book about love and grace. So he moved the discussion off the Bible onto love and grace. And for the next hour, people called in asking me why I was such a bigot. So I decided I'm not going to do that again.
Welcome to the world of sexual politics.
There you go.
Yes.
And I realized I didn't have the language to speak to the culture in which I live, what I believe to be true, which is the historic Christian teaching about sexuality. Confining sex to a marriage between a man and a woman is good news for everyone. So I took a sabbatical in Cambridge in England, and then I took 4.5 years to go underground and wrote this book. And now I've emerged because I think I can look people in the face and say it, whether they agree with me or not.
Yes. So you categorize our world today as the I world, and that is I for individual. And also, significantly, I think we've got to have it now.
Yeah.
How do you describe the character and the conduct of people in that world, as opposed to, say, past decades when, for instance, you say you grew up watching Leave It to Beaver?
Exactly.
Such a different world.
Oh, it was. The world in which I grew up in, the idea that we would have same-sex marriage would have been literally inconceivable. Right now, the Swiss Parliament is debating a bill to legalize incest. These points of discussion would not have even been conceivable back in the 50s and 60s, but now they're live and will probably be passed. And so I have to ask the question, what's changed in our world to make something that was inconceivable conceivable? And I think we now live in a world not of traditional morality that understood family and neighborhood and cities and friendships in non-sexual ways, save for a marriage. And we now live in a world in which we're basically told that individuals can do what they want, so long as they don't hurt someone, so long as they, whatever they do with someone else is consensual. And probably the third, what I call the third taboo, is that don't you dare tell anybody else that their life decisions are wrong, or the fury of hell will be released upon you.
Yes. But I don't think you're arguing for a return to the Leave It to Beaver days of the 50s.
Nope.
When it all seemed so much more simple.
No, in the United States, I think the Christian community was trapped between either trying to go back to that T world or accommodating itself to the I world. But the reality is that even if we wanted to go back, the social conditions necessary for the T world to exist have evaporated. They're no longer there. But I don't think that we have to live in this world of excessive individualism. I believe we can live in what I call an R world, a relational world, in which relationships and love and intimacy come first.
Let me ask you this then. What's wrong with looking after number one? It's a tough world out there.
It is.
So many of them are against me.
Yep.
And I need to have some kind of self-respect and look after myself.
Well, I think in the I world, you better. I think in this world in which we presently live, there is no guarantee that there's going to be somebody around to take care of you when you grow older. The assumptions that either parents will do that, or children, I should say, spouse, our social fabric is evaporating, and I think we feel compelled to look after number one, and I think it's a survival mechanism.
Okay. There have been enormous advances at many levels to bring us to the world we have today, and many, many good things.
Yes.
Compared with decades and even centuries past, we've had seen the abolition of slavery. Women are in a much better position today than they were. We've got far greater freedoms. I suppose we think we do.
Mm-hmm.
That's all a good thing, though.
It is. I don't want to go back to a world of slavery. I don't want to go back to a world of the subjection of women. I certainly don't want to go back to a world of patriarchy that was pretty unhealthy. Mm. So as a Christian, I don't want to go back to those places, and I don't want to communicate to the world that I do, because I don't. Christianity doesn't need to be reactionary, and it doesn't need to be accommodating. It can have it has a forward vision for how it is that we can live well together.
Because it has been reactionary
yeah.
in a lot of its responses
Absolutely.
To this world.
Absolutely. And when people think that they understand Christianity, they've already been there and done that, I understand that, because there's been some enormously harmful things that the church has justified, that the church has not stood up for those who are being done an injustice. And then, quite frankly, the people in the name of Christ do ridiculous things, like the person that said the world was going to end so we didn't have to do this show.
Lucky we planned a bit.
Exactly. It makes us look stupid, and I understand that.
How secure do you think the I world, as you describe it, is?
I mean, in one sense, its greatest strength is its greatest weakness. I mean, we live in a world in which we're allowed to do things that people never imagined. We live in a world that understands that we can have freedom from authority and freedom from want and freedom from nature. I mean, this is an enormous advance. But the problem is that if you live in a world with so few boundaries, you live in a world that by definition is also going to be a world that's insecure. Mm. You're never going to know if the pathway that you took to happiness is the one that actually makes you most happy. So everyone in the I world is asking the question, would I have been happier if I had been with this person or that person? Would I have been happier if I'd pursued this kind of sexual relationship or another? Would I have been happier if I'd pursued a different position, a different job? And you're never going to be able to answer that question in the I world. The I world is a world in which the word contentment does not exist. It's a world that is constantly seeking happiness, finding the shortcut to happiness. And in one sense, we never know if we've gotten where we need to get to.
So with the title of your book, Sex and the I World, our society, I think, seems saturated, infatuated, and with sex wherever we turn.
Yep.
But you say friendship is a much higher thing than that, perhaps especially when sex is not involved.
Yeah. I think human beings want to love and to be loved. And I think it's the thing that we crave more than anything else. I think every single one of us who walks this earth is concerned that at our heart, we're not lovable. And a friendship, unlike a family or a neighborhood or a city where people have to take care of you because you're family, you're part of us. The idea of a friendship in what somebody freely chooses to love you for who you are, and they, and you love them for who you are, that is an enormous and a wondrous thing. And I think it's one of the most enormous and wondrous things. And we live in a world now that says, well, if you want to have the best possible friendship and you want to express yourself in the deepest way, you need to sexualize that relationship. And yet my point is, you take in a relationship of friendship in which people are loving each other for who they are without what you're getting off of them. When you introduce sex into that relationship, by definition, you're introducing something that now you have an equation where you're saying, you know, I want something, or I want something from that person. You introduce something, a kind of confusion. And I think the phrase in our culture that we use is, my relationship just got complicated. And we hear so many times, well, what's going on? Well, it's complicated. And I think all of us know when we use the word it's complicated, it's because something has gotten in the way of the altruistic nature of our friendship. It doesn't have to be sex, but I think sex is part of that. And now we're trying to find our way back to something that was really good, and we don't really know how to get there.
But it's such a drug, isn't it?
It is. Sex,
it's complicated, but it's so intoxicating.
Oh, it is. I mean, sex is pleasurable. I mean, and I think it was made to be. I think that, I mean, to be perfectly honest, I don't know that I would have had kids without it.
I think you might be right there.
If it hadn't been pleasurable.
Or you'd be even here.
Well, exactly.
Or me.
No, I think it's pleasurable for a very good reason, and it's pleasurable independentness of having kids. But I think it's that's the reason it was created.
Do you think friendship is of a higher order than marriage, marriage partnership?
I do. And then probably in the Christian world, that sounds like heresy. But I think the Christian world has made an idol of marriage to some degree, in the sense that in almost any church I go to, the assumption is that if you're married, you're okay. And if you're not married, there's something wrong with you. And if God had intended all of us to be married, to be happy, then he's actually done a poor job of designing things. But he didn't. He designed us for intimate, deep, meaningful relationships. And if we're married, great. But if we're not married, each of us is given friendship. And quite frankly, if you're married and you don't have friends, your life is lacking something that's necessary.
The interesting thing that I take away from this book, after you've clearly thought a lot through over these 5 years, you end up being an optimist.
I am.
Despite a pretty searing critique of the world.
Yeah.
Why so?
Because I think down deep, all of us crave and we're made for love. And because we all crave and are made for love, I mean, I think we are yearning, all of us are all yearning for what is good. We're all yearning for that. And I think when we find it, we're drawn to it like a moth to a flame. And so on the one hand, I can say, well, this world is not functioning the way it was designed. But I can say it another way. This world functions best when we function in the way it was designed. And I don't see why we can't find our way back there.
But our love is always going to be flawed and imperfect, isn't it?
It will. And I suppose that's what we would call the miracle of Christian faith and religious faith, and the belief that God is love. And the belief that while our love may be imperfect, God's love for us and his grace extends to us, and we can be more than we thought we'd be. One of my favorite lines from U2 is Bono out there on the stage singing, "You do not know how beautiful you are." And I hear that's the voice of God telling each and every one of us, we're more beautiful than we imagine.
Professor Dale Keane, it's a great book and a great exploration of our modern world. Thank you so much for coming in and sharing it with us.
I'm delighted.
On Open House tonight. Thank you.